"Use, Mr. Yagyello?" cried Jack. And to himself, chuckling much, he added, "It would be a damned odd thing if they proved rams, you know."
"Jews, I mean," said Yagyello. "You cannot make friends with Jews. They have been beaten and spitted on so long they are the enemy, like the laconical helots, and women have been domestical helots for so much longer. There is no friendship between enemies, even in a truce. They are always watching. And if you are not friends, where is the real knowledge?"
"Some speak of love," suggested Stephen.
"Love!" cried the young man. "But love is a creature of time, whereas friendship is not. Your own Shakespeare says—"
The sailors never learnt what their own Shakespeare said, because a midshipman sent by the officer of the watch came to say that the weather, lifting to leeward, had disclosed 28 sail of merchantmen, together with a frigate and a brig, thought to be Melampus and Dryad.
"A Baltic convoy, for sure," said Jack. "No one could mistake Melampus. But still I think we may as well have a look. Doctor, will you entertain Mr. Yagyello with reasons until we come back? I have great hopes we may finish our dinner with something better than condemned Essex cheese."
"Mr. Yagyello," said Stephen when they had gone, "I should like to ask you about the ancient gods of Lithuania, which, I understand, still lead a ghostly life among your Boers, about the worship of oak trees, the white-tailed eagle, and the plica polonica, the beaver, the mink, and the wizened or European bison. But first, before it should slip my mind, I must tell you I am charged with a message to be delivered in a most tactful, diplomatic way, so that it does not in the least resemble an order, so improper to a guest, but so that it shall have an equivalent force and effect. Your agility in the upper rigging excites wonder and admiration, my dear sir, but at the same time it causes a very great uneasiness of mind, an uneasiness proportionable to the esteem in which you are held, and it would please the captain if you would confine yourself to the lower platforms, technically known as tops.
Does he believe that I shall fall?
He believes that laws of gravity bear more severely on soldiers than on seamen, and since you are a hussar, he is convinced that you will fall. I shall do as he wishes, of course. But he is mistaken, you know. Heroes never fall. At least not fatally.
I was not aware that you were a hero, Mr. Yagyello.
The Ariel took on a surprising lean as she brought the stiff breeze abaft the beam, set her t'gallants and weather stunsails, and dashed down on the Melampus at a good 10 knots, her lee rail buried in the foam. Yagyello had a good hold on the table, but a lee lurch unseated him, and he slid to the deck, where for a moment his spurs, caught in the matting, held him prisoner.
"Of course I am a hero," he said, getting up and laughing very cheerfully. "Every man is a hero of his own tale. Surely, Dr. Maturin, every man must look on himself as wiser and more intelligent and more virtuous than the rest. So how could he see himself as the villain, or even as a minor character? And you must have noticed that heroes are never beaten. They may be undone for a while, but they always do themselves up again and marry the virtuous young gentlewoman."
"I have noticed it, indeed. There are some eminent exceptions, sure, but upon the whole I am convinced you are right. Perhaps it is that which makes your novel, or tale, a little tedious."
"Ah, Dr. Maturin," cried Yagyello, "if I could find an Amazon, one of a tribe of women that never have been oppressed, one that I could be friends with, equal friends— Oh, how I should love her!"
"Alas, my dear, men destroyed the last Amazon 2,000 years ago, and I fear your heart must go virgin to the grave."
"What is that noise? Like bears on the roof?"
asked Yagyello, breaking off.
"It is the launching of a boat, and from the howling of the mariners I collect that it will be some time before we see our dessert. What say you to a game of chess while we are waiting? It may be no conclusive test of our relative wisdom, virtue, or intelligence, but I can think of no better."
"With all my heart," said Yagyello. "But if I lose, you are not to suppose that it will make the least difference to my conviction."
The game might not prove much about the intelligence of the players, but it provided certain evidence that Yagyello's virtue, or at least his kindness, was greater than Stephen's. Stephen, playing to win, had launched a powerful attack on the Queen's side. He had launched it one move too early. A vile pawn still masked his heavy artillery, and now Jagiello was wondering how he could play to lose, how he could make a mistake that should not be woundingly obvious to his opponent. Jagiello's chess was far beyond Stephen's. His power of dissembling his emotions was not, and Stephen was watching his expression of ill-assumed stupidity with some amusement when the boat was heard to return. A moment later, Jack came in, followed by his steward, bearing a plum cake the size of a moderate cartwheel, and by two powerful hands, with a hamper that clanked glassy as they set it down, while the pitter of hoofs overhead and a melancholy baa told of the presence of at least one devoted sheep. Jagiello, with a look of relief, instantly moved the board to make room for the cake, solving his problem by upsetting all the pieces.
"I am sorry to have been so tedious long," said Jack, "but I'm sure you will find it worth the wait. Melampus has always done herself as proud as the mansion house. Cut, and come again, Mr. Jagiello. This only has to last us until Gothenburg."
Gothenburg, a melancholy town, most of it quite recently burned, inhabited by tall, spare melancholiacs dressed in grey wool, much given to drinking and self-murder. The river brought three suicides past the Ariel during her brief stay, but kind to strangers if not to themselves. The commandant at once provided powder, best red-letter cylinder powder, together with a present of smoked reindeer's tongues and a barrel of salted honey buzzards. These he gave to Stephen, saying, "Pray, accept this small keg of buzzards."
"Buzzards, my dear sir?" cried Stephen, startled from his usual calm.
"Oh, not common buzzards," said the commandant, "nor rough-legged buzzards. You need not be afraid. They are all honey buzzards, I do assure you."
"I am fully persuaded of it, sir, and return my best thanks," said Stephen. "May I ask how they came there?" he added, looking attentively at the cask.
"I put them there myself," said the commandant with pride. "I put them there with my own hands, choosing each one. Fine plump birds, though I should not say it."
"Did you shoot them, sir?"
"Oh, no," said the commandant, quite shocked. "You must never shoot a honey buzzard. It ruins the flavour. No, we strangle them."
"Do they not resent this?"
"I think not," said the commandant. "It happens at night. I have a small house at Falsterbo, a peninsula at the far end of the sound with a few trees upon it. Here the birds come in the autumn, myriads of birds flying south, and great numbers roost in the wood, so many you may scarcely see the trees. We choose the best, pluck them down, and so strangle them. It has been done for ever. All the best salted buzzards come from Falsterbo, and no doubt they are used to it."
"Do eagles also appear, sir?" asked Stephen.
Oh, yes, indeed. Do you sort them, too?" "Oh, no," said the commandant, amused. "A salted eagle would be a very whimsical dish. They are always pickled, you know, otherwise they would eat intolerably dry."
While the powder was coming aboard, Stephen said,
"How I should like to see this Falsterbo."
"Perhaps you will," said Jack. "The commandant tells me the Danes are very thick on the ground in the belt. Melampus said the same. And I have a great mind to run through the sound. Let us have a word with the pilot." "Mr. Pellworm," said he, when the Baltic pilot came in, an ancient man, Jack's old and highly respected acquaintance.
"Mr. Pellworm, I have a great mind to run through the sound. I know the Danes have shifted their buoys, but do you think you could take her through the narrows in the night, the tail end of the night?"
"Man and boy," said Mr. Pellworm, "man and boy, I threaded the sound till I know it like the back of my hand. Like the back of my hand, sir. I do not need their old sea marks to take a ship of Ariel's draught through the narrows in the night, or right down to Falsterbo, for that matter, with the Swedish lights."
"And what do you think of the wind, Mr. Pellworm?"
"Why, sir, at this time of the year we always say, in by the sound, out by the belt, because the westerlies always hang a little north in the one and a little south in the other. Never you fear for the wind, sir. It will stand fair for the sound these next 3 or 4 days, or I am a Dutchman."
"Then let it be so, Mr. Pellworm. We will weigh the moment the powder hoy casts off, and that will get us through the narrows in the darkness."
The pilot was no Dutchman, as far as the wind's direction was concerned. To begin with, it carried the aerial down the Kattegat at a fine, brisk pace. But he was mistaken as to its force. In the middle watch, Jack stirred from his sleep, listened to the song of the water along the ship's side, put a jacket over his nightshirt, and went on deck. Diffused moonlight, a quiet black sea, and the aerial slipping along under all plain sail. Perhaps 5 knots, certainly not more. Far out on the larboard bow, a light on the Swedish shore. Surely it could not be the Kullen. Surely the Kullen must be well astern by now. He stepped over to the binnacle, took the logboard with its chalked record of wind, course, and speed, and quickly worked out his position. Yes, it was certainly the Kullen. The pilot came over to him and coughed apologetically.
"May I have the watch below to make more sail, sir?"
he asked.
"No," said Jack. "It is not worth it. Let us wait until 8 bells."
They were sadly behind their time, but it was not worth calling all hands now. Even with royals, skyscrapers, and stunsails aloft and alow, they would still have to pass the Narrows in the daylight.
"Mr. Jevons, is it not?" he said to a muffled midshipman in the dimness. "Pray go below and fetch my boat cloak. It is hanging by the barometer. And take great care not to wake the doctor."
Wrapped in his cloak, he stood by the stern lantern, watching the sky and the ship, and considering his course of action. Upon the whole, he thought he should carry on rather than go round by the belt. The danger was not very great, and the saving of time outweighed it. What he really disliked about this late passage was that the Danish gunboats from Copenhagen and Saltholm would be perfectly ready for him, the news having run ahead, and that, if it were to fall flat calm, might be unpleasant. They were an enterprising lot, and they had already captured a number of sloops and brigs of war. However, he thought he should carry on. And while he turned this over in his mind, he also reflected upon some aspects of life at sea and the unvarying routine he had known in every ship he had sailed in. A harsh, cold, uncomfortable, demanding routine often enough, but one that did at least bring order out of chaos. An acknowledged framework, commandments from on high, sometimes arbitrary, sometimes archaic, but generally workable and always more immediate, more obviously enforced than the Decalogue. An infinity of problems within that framework, of course, but the order provided answers to most of them, or cut them short with sudden death. 7 bells, and from all round the ship there came the cry, "All's well!" 8 bells, and while the frowsy larbolens were being mustered, warm, pink, and unwashed from their hammocks, the mate of the watch heaved the log.
"Turn!" cried the mate.
28 seconds later,
"Nip!"
cried the quartermaster.
"What have you?"
called Jack.
4 knots and 3 fathoms, sir, if you please," replied Mr. Fenton.
It was much as he had thought, a steady decline. Still, he could always creep along under the Swedish batteries, or even put into Helsingborg. While both watches were on deck, he gave orders to make more sail and return to his meditation. The eastern sky was lightening, and already the ritual of washing the almost spotless deck was well in hand. The pumps were wheezing round, all was awash, and Jack went below to put on some clothes and get out of the main topman's way as they moved aft with buckets, sand, holy stones, and swabs. The Ariel was a very little ship, but she did her commander proud. As well as his great cabin, he had 2 little booths opening off it, his sleeping and dining cabins, and seeing that neither was encumbered with guns, Ariel being flush-decked, there was just enough room in each to sling a cot. He had put Stephen into one, moving the dining table aft, and at this table he now sat, comfortably enough, until the rhythmical beating of swabs told him that the deck, unnecessarily washed, had now been unnecessarily dried. He returned to his place, there watching the steady progress of the ship's exactly ordered life, the unfolding promise of the day, scanning the clouds for the probable behaviour of the wind, and watching the coast move slowly, very slowly, by. He was still there when Stephen appeared, unusually early for him, carrying a borrowed telescope.
"Good morning, Jack," he said,
and then, staring about him,
"Mother of God! It is narrower than I had supposed!"
Narrow it was. On the shore to larboard walked Swedes, clearly to be seen in the bright sunlight, and on that to starboard Danes. 3 miles of sea between them, and the Ariel in about the middle, rather nearer the Swedish side, creeping south with little more than steerage way upon her.
"Have you seen them yet?" he asked.
"Have I seen what?"
"Why, the eider ducks, of course. Do you not remember that Jagiello promised us eider ducks in the Sound? I had thought that was what you were looking at so earnestly."
"So he did. But I've not really been attending. Still, I believe I can show you something that will please you even more. Do you see those green roofs and terraces? That is Elsinore."
"Elsinore itself? The very Elsinore? God bless my soul. And yours too, Joy. A noble pile. I view it with reverence. I had supposed it to be merely ideal. Hush! Do not move. They come! They come!"
A flight of duck wheeled overhead, large, powerful, heavy, swift-flying duck in files, and pitched between the castle and the ship.
"Eiders, without a doubt," said Stephen, his telescope fixed upon them. "They are mostly young, but there on the right is a drake in full dress. He dives. I see his black belly. This is a day to mark with a white stone."
A great jet of white water sprang from the surface of the sea. The eiders vanished.
"Good God!" he cried, staring in amazement. "What was that?"
"They have opened on us with their mortars," said Jack. "That was what I was looking for."
A puff of smoke appeared on the nearer terrace, and half a minute later a second fountain rose 200 yards short of the Ariel.
"The Goths!" cried Stephen, glaring angrily at Elsinore. "They might have hit the birds! These Danes have always been a very froward people. Do you know, Jack, what they did at Clonmacnoise? They burnt it, the thieves! And their queen sat on the high altar, mother naked, uttering oracles in a heathen frenzy. Ota was the strumpet's name. It is all of a piece. Look at Hamlet's mother. I only wonder her behaviour caused any comment."
The next shot pitched well over the Ariel, sending up its plume a cable's length to larboard. Jack took the telescope and trained it on the battery. 5 whiffs of smoke that drifted away down the Sound. 5 fountains in the sea. 3 beyond. 2 short, and the long, sullen roar.
"Tolerably good practice," he observed. "They are increasing their charge."
The pilot came aft and said,
"Shall I put you into Helsingborg, sir?"
"No,"
said Jack, glancing at the Swedish port a little abaft the larboard beam.
"Carry on down the Sound, Mr. Pelworm. You may shave the Swedish shore as close as you please, however."
And to Stephen he said,
"Tossing a 200-pound bombshell at a moving object is a chancy business at this range, you know. A hit-or-miss affair. Nothing like lobbing them into a fortification or an anchored fleet. And they have just as much chance of hitting us if we put back as if we stand on. Indeed, rather more, since we should be going from them in a right line. Mr. Jagiello, good morning to you. The Danes are busy, as you see."
"I wish they may burst," said Jagiello. "Good morning, sir. Doctor, your servant."
A group of 3 shells, directly in the Ariel's path, sent up 3 distinct columns, instantly shattered into a confused mass of flying water as the charges exploded under the surface.
"Down with your helm!" called Jack,
and the Ariel began to perform a languid jig, swerving, letting fly her sheets, or hauling aft, diminishing and increasing her gentle pace. Never by very much, but at least enough to make sure that every fresh discharge would have to be the result of a separate calculation on the part of the Danes.
"Mr. Hyde," he said to the first lieutenant, pointing to a number of large fish that lay belly up where the shells had exploded, "let a net be put over the side. We may as well profit by the situation."
Slowly, slowly, the nearer sea moved by. The shore seemed quite motionless. Sometimes the courses and the topsails flapped, with no thrust in them, and the hands on the forecastle could be heard whistling quietly for a breeze. They had not much time for brooding, however. At 7 bells hammocks were piped up, at 8 the men were piped to breakfast, and the pleasant smell of frying fish wafted about the deck.
"Were you ever in Elsinore, Mr. Jagiello?"
asked Jack. "Oh, many a time, sir," said Jagiello. "I know it well. I believe I could show you Hamlet's grave from here."
"I was really wondering whether they were 10- or 13-inch mortars on the upper terrace," said Jack, "but I should be very happy to see Hamlet's grave as well."
"Both 10 and 13, sir.
"'And if you go a little to the right from the farthest turret, there are some trees. "'And among those trees there is the grave. "'You can just make out the rocks.'
"'So there he lies,' said Jack, his telescope levelled. "'Well, well, we must all come to it. "'But it was a capital piece. Capital. "'I never laughed so much in my life.'
"'A capital piece indeed,' said Stephen. "'And I doubt I could have done much better myself. "'But, do you know, I have never in my own mind classed it among the comedies. "'Pray, did you read it recently?'
"'I never read it at all,' said Jack. "'That is to say, not right through. "'No, I did something better than that. I acted in it. "'There, the upper terrace fires. "'I was a midshipman at the time.'
"'What part did you play?'
"'Jack did not answer at once. "'He was watching for the fall, counting the seconds. "'At the 28th it came, well pitched up, but wide to starboard.
"'Port your helm there!' he called, and then went on. "'I was one of the sexton's mates. "'There were 17 of us, and we had real earth to dig, brought from shore. "'It played old Harry with the deck, but by God it was worth it. "'Lord, how we laughed!' The carpenter was the sexton, and instead of going on in that tedious way about whose grave it was, he made remarks about the ship's company. I was Ophelia, too. That is to say, one of the Ophelias.
Another salvo tore up the sea, true in line this time, but short, and as he watched, Jack caught the flash of a single mortar. Again the line was true, and he saw the shell soar to its height, soar until it was no more than a small black ball against the pale sky, then curve down, racing down, growing fast, to burst well astern.
"'Judging from the height,' he said, "'I fancy they've reached their full elevation and their full charge.'
The next salvo confirmed his judgment. The last 100 yards had carried them beyond the battery's malice, and he suggested that they too should have breakfast.
"'The smell of that fish is more than I can bear,' he said privately to Stephen.
At the breakfast table, with a fine view of the narrows and now silent Elsinore, Stephen said,
"'So you were Ophelia in your youth, Captain Aubrey?'
"'A part of Ophelia. But in this case the part was greater than the whole. I was called back 3 times, and the other fellows were not called back at all, even the one that was drowned in a green dress with sprigs. 3 times, upon my honour.
"'How did the poor young lady come to be divided up?'
"'Why, there was only one midshipman in the flagship, pretty enough for a girl.' But his voice was broke, and he could not keep in tune neither. So for the part where she has to sing, I put on the dress and piped up with my back to the audience. But neither of us was going to be drowned and buried in real earth, admiral or no admiral. So that part fell to a youngster who could not defend himself, and that made 3 of us, do you see?
Jack smiled, his mind going back to the West Indies, where the performance had taken place. And after a while he sang,
"Young men will do it, and they come to it. By cock they are to blame." Yes, alas, and it all ended unhappy, as I recall.
So it did, too, said Stephen, the pity of the world. I believe I shall go upstairs again if there is no more coffee left. I shall be sorry to miss any of the Baltic's wonders, they being, as you might say, some compensation for all the grief there is by land.
More eiders he saw, and later in the day, off the island of Saltholm, some very curious sea-duck that he could not identify, that he had no time to identify, for the breeze had freshened steadily, and now the Ariel was running at 8 knots. It was vexing, but on the other hand, without this fine turn of speed, she would never have reached Falsterbo with enough light for a perfect view of a white-tailed eagle, an enormous bird in full adult plumage that plucked a fish from the sea not 20 yards from the Ariel's stern. And then again her pace meant that no flotilla of gunboats, grim but slow, would attempt her.
"'I am glad to hear it,' he said, when Jack told him that the ship was now well out of their range,
that she was now steering to run between Bornholm and the main, and that if this breeze freshened still further, which seemed likely, they should join the Admiral in excellent time.
"'I am glad to hear it, because after today's excitement I should like a long quiet night to collect my ideas, for who knows what tomorrow may bring. Bearded swans, the phoenix himself, maybe. I shall turn in at once.'
No swans of any kind. No phoenix. A low sky, scudding cloud, a short, choppy grey sea, and the Ariel tearing along under close-reefed topsails. As it increased in force, the wind veered into the west, and then north of west, cutting up a sea that gave her a strong corkscrewing motion, while at the same time she pitched violently at short, very short intervals, working so that she spewed her oakum from the night heads to the bits. Stephen's stomach had withstood the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Indian Oceans, but the Baltic very nearly overcame him. He was not actually sick, but he exhibited a cold, copious salivation, a dislike for jovial company, facetiousness or merriment, and an intolerance of the notion of food. It was probably that nasty fish of yesterday, he thought. Burston-bellied fish might very well convey all manner of noxious principles. Only a fool would eat them. And only a fool would go to sea, exposing his frame to the falling damps. He kept the deck for the most part of the forenoon. There it was not so much a question of falling as of horizontal damps, for every time the Ariel plunged her head into a sea, sheets of spray and even solid water swept aft, piercing his armour at every joint, so that in time he was wet as well as cold, wet through and through. "Perhaps I shall go and see my colleague and beg 10 drops of the sulphureous ether, or, failing that, a little acid of sulphur dulcified," he said to himself. "The man is a very mere sot, but at least he has a medicine chest." And he turned to find a quarter-deck messenger to show him the way, a jolly pink child who wore a winged cap, such being the Ariel's whim. As they went below, he heard a cry of, "Sail ho! A cat 2 points on the starboard bow!" But he never paused. They had sighted another sail earlier in the day, a Dane for sure, said the officers who had cruised the Baltic all last summer in the Ariel, but with infinite reluctance Jack had let her run. His business was far too urgent for him to be chasing prizes, and it would be the same with this one. In any case, Stephen was not in the least interested in a prize. All he wanted was sulphureous ether. Alas, he found the mere sot in much the same state as himself, only worse. Speechless, careless of the world, pale green, unshaven, malodorous, and what was far more regrettable, he had drunk up all the ship's sulphureous ether, and had spilt the sulphuric acid. It was now eating its way through his counterpane, but he did not mind. The sooner it ate its way through the bottom of the ship, the better, he whispered. Stephen left him in disgust, and turning on the boy who had shown him the way to Mr. Graham's cabin, he said, "See what comes of your heathenish, superstitious custom of whistling. Your own surgeon sick, for shame. Let the captain be told that I am retiring to meditate, and that I beg to be excused from dining." He had not taken breakfast. He did not dine. He did not share the captain's tea. And when at last the Ariel shot into the calm waters of Karlskrona and saluted the admiral, he felt cold, glum, and weak. So weak indeed that when Ariel's gig was alongside the flagship and he himself clambering awkwardly aboard, the man-rope slipped from his hand and he fell, dropping like a sack. But Jack had prepared for this. His old friend was no seaman, never had been, and never would be a seaman. From the beginning of their acquaintance he had fallen from motionless ships and spars, motionless boats, and more than once he had even plunged between ship and boat when going up the side. Captain Aubrey had therefore given orders that the gig should hook on to the flagship as tight as a limpet, and that two powerful seamen should stand at the foot of the accommodation ladder
in case anyone should take a tumble.
These men, who knew very well what o'clock it was, caught Dr. Maturin's frail body as easily as a corded hammock. It weighed little more, and propelled him up the side again, urging him,
"To clap on with both hands, sir. Never say die. One more heave and we're home, safe and dry."
The captain of the fleet received them coldly, observing that the admiral was not at leisure, and that if Ariel were to be attached to the Baltic squadron, he would thank Captain Aubrey to wear an ensign of the proper colour. Sir James had recently been promoted vice-admiral of the Red, which any man might have discovered by taking a little trouble. The reception was roughly what Jack had expected ever since he heard that Manby was captain of the fleet. In the course of his career, and particularly during the fierier, more undisciplined early stages of it, he had made many solid, reliable friends, and some solid, reliable enemies, Manby being one of them. Yet this disagreeable impression did not last for long. A few minutes later a number of Swedish officers left the ship, and the Admiral's secretary, a grave young parson, showed Jack and Stephen into the great cabin. A noble room, although at present it looked more like a busy office than part of a man of war. Files everywhere, a desk covered with papers, and behind the desk a pale admiral, himself more like a jaded, work-worn minister than a sea officer. He was obviously tired, but he greeted them cordially.
"It must be years since we met, Captain Aubrey," he said, having congratulated Jack on his rapid passage.
"The last time was at Gibraltar, sir, just after your splendid victory in the Gut," said Jack.
"Yes, yes," said Sir James. "The Lord was good to us that day."
Stephen had been a spectator of that bloody affair. He thought the violent death of 2,000 Frenchmen and Spaniards an odd proof of the Lord's goodness, but he had known other able men with the Admiral's view of divine providence. During the brief interval, while Jack delivered his dispatches before introducing him, he studied Sir James's face. Grave, heavy-lidded eyes, a distinguished, earnest face, not much given to merriment. He knew Sir James's reputation as a blue-light admiral, a friend to tracts and psalms, but he had known men of the book prove most effectual men of the sword as well, and when the admiral turned to him and he caught his intelligent, penetrating, politely attentive look, he felt his heart rise. This man was no fool.
"Allow me to name Dr. Maturin, sir, who also brings you a communication from the Admiralty," said Jack. "Sir James Samaras."
"I am very happy to meet you, Dr. Maturin," said the Admiral. "I had been half expecting you, sir, and I believe I know what your letter contains. If you will forgive me, I will read it at once. Will you take a little refreshment? I always drink a glass or two of wine at this time and take a biscuit. My brother Richard recommends it. I believe you know him, sir."
This with a bow to Stephen. He rang his bell. The wine appeared on the instant, and having served the others, he retired to his desk with his glass, his dispatches, and the letter. Dick Samaras. Yes, of course Stephen knew him, though he had not made the connection. A surgeon, a tolerably good physiologist, though obstinate and wrong-headed about the ligature of the external iliac in the case of aneurysm of the femoral. Stephen thoroughly approved of his recommendation, however. The wine was champagne, a fine, fruity champagne, not too cold, and it went down very gratefully with a biscuit. He felt his weakness recede, his mind grow sharper, less gloomy, more decisive. He reflected upon the medicinal use of alcohol. He also reflected, for the dispatch was long, on Jack's expression. It was respectful, naturally enough, for not only was a vice-admiral a very much greater man than a post-captain, but Jack also entertained a sincere regard for Sir James as a man and as a most capable, resolute officer. It also had a slight resemblance to Captain Aubrey's church-going face, with just a touch of sanctimoniousness, or rather of primness, a look that sat uneasily on that red, weather-beaten, open, candid, habitually cheerful face. It was as though he were himself determined to follow the advice he had given before they set out across the harbour.
"Do not get drunk, or talk bawdy, or blaspheme, or even swear when you are aboard the flag, Stephen. The Admiral is very particular, and it will cost you a guinea every time you take the Lord's name in vain."
Jack, for his part, reflected upon the Admiral. Lord, how the poor man had aged! It was not surprising. Even as a commodore of a small squadron, Jack had been cruelly harassed by paperwork, by the responsibility for very important decisions, whose execution lay in others' hands, by the problems of cooperation with the army and with civilian authorities, by a thousand questions that had nothing to do with the running or the fighting of his ship. For the commander-in-chief in the Baltic, it must be very, very much worse.
"It is much as I had expected," said the Admiral, laying the letter on the dispatch. "So you are poor Mr. Ponsish's successor, sir. How I pray you may be more successful. Is Captain Aubrey aware of the nature of your mission?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then I have no doubt that you would both like to see Mr. Thornton, my political adviser. As far as I know, the situation on Grimsholm has not changed, but he has all the most recent information."
Stephen knew Thornton well, a Foreign Office man with a flair for intelligence and a singular grasp of detail. They greeted one another with the odd, ambiguous civility that had become second nature to both, betraying nothing but some degree of social acquaintance, even in spite of the present circumstances.
"Dr. Maturin has come out to take Senor Ponzish's place," said the Admiral, "and I have just told him that I know of no change in the position on Grimsholm. But I speak without the book, and I am sure you can make a more authoritative statement."
"On the island itself, there has been no material change," said Thornton. "We have two recent reports of a certain amount of discontent, caused by a lack of wine and tobacco, but it seems that Colonel Dullestrett has the situation well in hand. He is popular with the garrison, and he has strengthened his authority by sending three more officers away to Danzig. But on the mainland, the French take the matter very seriously indeed. A most reliable source tells us that in spite of all his difficulties, Oudinot means to replace the Catalans by a mixed brigade of Poles, Saxons, and French. And while these are being assembled and hurried to the coast, he is sending a General Mercier, together with the former commandant, Colonel Ligier, to take control. They are to bring Dullestrett the Legion d'Honneur and the offer of an independent command in Italy. On Tuesday they reach Hollenstein on their way to Gobau. It is not impossible that they have already taken ship. In the meantime, all supplies for Grimsholm have been cut off, both from Pomerania and Denmark. Apart from these reports, I have nothing new except for a more exactly detailed account of Dullestrett's forces and the disposition of his guns. He has started to excavate a new battery to sweep the approaches from the mainland. He handed Stephen the list of units, territorial units, whose names were as familiar to Stephen as his own. Saint-Félieu, Vrette de Mar, Palafrugel, Tossa, Saint-Père Pescador for the sea, Empordà for the plain, Viche, Mollo, Ripoll, and many more for the mountain. There were the names of their officers, too, many of them equally familiar. He mused for a time while Jack and the Admiral studied the chart of the waters around Grimsholm, a chart with recent soundings taken from a Danish pilot, or talked to Thornton about numbers, provisions, sources of supply. In an expectant pause he said, "It appears to me that this is a situation where we must risk all at one throw, and do so at once. There is no time for deliberation. I suggest that I shall be landed on the island as soon as possible, certainly before this General Mercier arrives, if he is not already there. If once I can get ashore, I feel reasonably confident of success. But I cannot think that a man of war is the best conveyance. Many of the soldiers on the island are sea Catalans, and they would recognize her at once, whatever her colors or disguise. Above all, since, as I understand, the Ariel has often appeared in the Baltic. They would blow her, or any boat belonging to her, out of the water. No, I should prefer to go in a Danzig or Danish vessel ostensibly bringing supplies. Nay, bringing supplies, in fact, for if it were loaded with the wine and tobacco that the garrison have lacked so long, my task would be sensibly lighter. No doubt, sir, you have a suitable prize?"
"I doubt it," said the Admiral. "So many foreigners are allowed to carry trade or naval stores to England under license that we take very few. And my impression is that the few we have taken this last month have already been sent in, but I will make certain."
He rang and called for an immediate report. While it was coming, Thornton spoke quietly to Stephen about the papers that Ponzish had taken with him to prove his statements. The proclamations, edicts, copies of the Moniteur, Catalan and Spanish broadsheets, even neutral publications which made it clear that the whole of Bonaparte's conduct was in complete contradiction with his promises. The atmosphere in the great cabin had become extremely grave. In the last few minutes the attempt had taken on a living immediacy, moving from the area of general discussion and the weighing of possibilities to that of immediate action. And all those present knew that when Maturin said, "All must be risked at one throw," the all included his own life. They looked at him with some of the respect due to a corpse or a man under the sentence of death, and Jack with the deepest concern.
"I have other examples of nearly all Ponzish's documents," Stephen said. "I also have an authenticated copy of the unpublished great excommunication pronounced against Bonaparte by the Holy Father. Three of the gentlemen on Grimsholm are Knights of Malta, and I believe it will have a very powerful effect on them."
The report arrived. There were no Danish or Danzig prizes within a week's reach.
"I was afraid that was the case," said the Admiral. "Had you rather wait, Dr. Maturin?"
"Oh, no," said Stephen. "At this stage a day is a year."
"If I may say so, sir," said Jack, "I believe I see a way out of the difficulty.
We sighted two Danes this morning. Since I was aware that speed was of the first importance, I did not chase, but I did notice that one of them, a cat, made no attempt to escape. She carried on under courses, steering for Riga, and I make no doubt she was sailing under your license. Now, sir, the wind serves, and the weather is clearing fast. Ariel, as you know, sir, is a very fair sailor, and if I might have your permission to, as it were, suspend the cat's license, I believe I could overhaul her. She was heavy, she was slow, and I believe she was short-handed.
The Admiral considered, whistling silently.
That is a possible solution, he said. It is not particularly scrupulous, but necessity knows no law. On the other hand, there is the possibility of missing her and of thereby losing 2 days. The alternative is to wait until one of my cruisers picks up a Dane, licensed or not. It is more certain. But they are scattered from the Olands down to Rügen. Orders would have to reach them, and we should be obliged to pay for the certainty with time. What says Dr. Maturin?
I have every confidence in Captain Aubrey's ability to seize upon anything that swims, said Maturin, and this is a situation in which I believe we must not lose a minute. Ever since he had taken to the sea he had been harassed by the cry, "Lose not a minute," and it gave him a certain pleasure to use it himself at last. "Lose not a minute," he repeated, savouring the words, and went on. As for the moral issue, are we to weigh the hypothetical inconvenience suffered by the cat against the certain death of several thousand men? For I understand that if the island cannot be induced to submit, it must be stormed. Now that the whole process was in train, now that the long fuse had been lit, he felt a curious levity mingling with his thoughts, and he was tempted to repeat Jack Aubrey's joke about always choosing the lesser of two weevils. In most circumstances he would have done so, but there was something about Admiral Saurez, an indefinable, unaffected magnitude, that made him keep his amusement to himself. Yet for all Sir James's real dignity, Stephen did not hesitate to interrupt the technical discussion between the sailors some moments later. "I should like to raise the point of wine and tobacco once more," he said, emerging from his thoughts. "Would it be possible, sir, to charge the Ariel with an adequate supply of these commodities, so that the eventual merchantman will in fact be found to be what she professes to be?"
"Tobacco, certainly," said the Admiral. "Wine may be more difficult, though I dare say the wardrooms of the squadron would yield a fair amount, and we could always fill up with rum if you feel that would be suitable."
"Rum would answer tolerably well," said Stephen, "although wine would be better. And now, sir, I have some more important observations. This is clearly an expedition that must end either in complete success or in complete failure. There is little point in discussing the failure, so if you please, I will speak only of the happier event. As you are no doubt aware, I made it a condition of my stepping in that the Catalan troops on Grimsholm should not be treated as prisoners of war, and that they should be carried to Spain with arms and baggage at His Majesty's charges. It is a small price to pay for the bloodless delivery of such a fortress, I believe, and in any case I am intimately convinced that once they are in the peninsula they will at once engage on Lord Wellington's side."
"It would indeed be a trifling price," said the Admiral. "Unfortunately I have the transports here just at hand. Mr. Ponsish made the same condition."
very good," said Stephen. "I now come to another point. The commanders of the transports should be strongly impressed with the necessity for according the Catalan officers all the usual complements of salutes and guns and flags and so on, with all or even more than all the usual ceremony. Their position is irregular, their pride susceptible to the last degree. The least appearance of a slight might have the most unfortunate effects." He paused. "But I'm running too far ahead. Ideally, sir, the operation would proceed on these lines. The emissary is landed from the merchantman, while the aerial and the transports remain out of sight. He carries his point. After a stated interval, the aerial comes nearer to see his signal. She, in her turn, calls the transports, which come in with a body of gunners sufficiently numerous to man the batteries, and the transfer takes place at once, while the prospect of the journey home still has its full exhilarating effect, and the indignation against the French is at its height. For the sooner they are out, and the sooner the possibility of jealousies or disagreement is done away with, the better. All this may be too much to ask, but perhaps some part, at least, may be feasible."
"As far as the transports are concerned," said Admiral Samarez, "I see no difficulty, always providing the wind serves. For, as you know, Dr. Maturin, we are wholly tributary to the winds. If Captain Aubrey can do his part with the necessary Dane, I believe we can do ours with the troop carriers and the gunners, and indeed with the wine and tobacco that you mentioned. I fully take your point about the necessity for a very rapid transfer, and I see, sir, that the Admiralty was not at all mistaken in advising me to rely upon Dr. Maturin's sagacity."
"The Admiralty was too kind entirely," said Stephen. "Too indulgent by far. But to tell you the truth of it, sir, this is a conjuncture in which I had rather be granted a single small cup of luck than a whole ton of wisdom."
Chapter 8. It was a black night for the squadron when the Ariel slipped her moorings and stood out into the rain-swept midnight sea. For she carried with her most of the wardroom's wine and an uneasy proportion of the foremast Jack's rum and tobacco, as well as 20 prime hands chosen from among the many Dutchmen, Poles, Finns, and Letts in the fleet. She left something near prostration behind her, with little to enliven or revive it. In all his experience of naval life, Stephen Maturin had never seen anything to equal the speed with which the Ariel was equipped. Boats crowded about her, stores flowing in under the immediate supervision of Sir James. The Admiral contributed 3 tierces of a noble claret to the cargo, observing that he should willingly drink green tea for the rest of the commission rather than jeopardize Ariel's chances. And after that, no wardroom could do less. She stood out, therefore, deeper in the water than she had stood in, more crowded than ever, with barrels still lashed provisionally here and there on deck, the purser and the mate of the hold out of their wits, and more than half of her crew suspiciously jolly, if not downright drunk.
"There will be a long defaulters list tomorrow,"
said Jack, in a tone that sensibly reduced the merriment. He had just emerged from a long session with Mr. Pellworm and the master, in which they had each independently laid down a course to intercept the licensed Dane they had passed not long before, the creeping, short-handed cat. 3 courses that coincided almost exactly, courses designed to find the cat in the first hours of full day.
"Mr. Fenton, we must have very good men at the wheel, and they must steer north 17 east exactly. Wittgenstein, the quartermaster from the flagship, will do for 1. An excellent seaman. I have sailed with him before. He will heave the log at every glass, keeping as near as possible to 6 knots, making or reducing sail accordingly. Above all, do not exceed. We must not pass in the darkness. And although I do not expect to see her before dawn, you will keep sharp, sober men at the masthead, changing them every glass. The lookout that first sights the cat shall have 10 guineas and remission of sins, short of mutiny, sodomy, or damaging the paintwork. I am to be called should anything occur, and should there be any change of wind."
In his earlier ships, he would have gone on to say that he was about to sup with the doctor on a very strange dish, a salted buzzard produced by the commandant at Gothenburg, and they would probably have talked about tomorrow's prospects for a while. But this was a temporary command. He hardly knew his officers, and in any case they seemed so young as almost to belong to another species. Their deference was burdensome, and it would require a real effort on his part, even at a social gathering, to cross the gap, as far as it could be crossed at all. But the godlike remoteness of command came naturally to him now, and having desired Fenton to repeat his orders and to place the written copy in the binnacle drawer, he went directly below. He found the buzzard already in pieces, carved not with the Christian carving knife and fork the steward had laid out, but with an instrument that Stephen hid under his napkin, as he said, "Forgive me, Jack. I have not actually begun, but I could not wait to see the creature's sternum. I learned a great deal about sternums in Paris."
"I am glad of that," said Jack, "and I am glad to see you are recovered."
"It was only a passing indisposition, caused perhaps by overindulgence in fish. In any event, the emotion of setting all in train has quite done away with it."
Jack had a notion that the easier motion of the ship might also have helped. The gale had blown itself out, and she was now slipping along with a quartering breeze, little roll and an even pitch, but he kept it to himself.
"Will you look upon this breastbone now, and at these sutures upon it?"
said Stephen, holding up the buzzard's keel. "You would say they were attachments for the sternal muscles, would you not?"
"I should have taken my oath upon it, I do assure you."
"So should I, until a few days ago. But in fact it appears that they are the points of union of the bones that make up the sternum in the fowl's earliest youth. It was an eminent academician who told me this, a man whose acquaintance I prize extremely. He envisages a whole new classification." Jack's attention wandered to the aerial's topgallant masts, struck down on deck in the recent blow, until Stephen said with unusual emphasis, "And those that put too much trust in a bird's toes as a generical symptom may find themselves compelled to call the nightjar and the osprey cousins."
"That would never do, I am sure," said Jack. "It eats rather like pig, don't it?"
"Very like pig. But when you consider that the honey buzzard's diet consists mainly in wasps and their brood, it is scarcely surprising. Allow me." He took the bones from Jack's plate and wrapped them in his handkerchief. "I was much impressed by your admiral," he said. "Admirable admiral, admirable force of decision. I have been so afraid of interminable shilly-shally and reluctance to come to the hard point of assuming responsibility."
"There is nothing like that about Sir James," said Jack. "You remember him at Gibraltar, tearing out after the combined squadron? No shilly-shally there, I believe. But, Stephen, did you not remark how terribly he has aged? He cannot be 60 yet, but he looks an old, old man."
"The appreciation of age is so relative. I dare say you look like a patriarch to the young men in the gun-room. I know that one of the midshipmen helped me across the street in Gothenburg, as though I were his grandsire."
"I dare say I do," said Jack, laughing. "I am quite certain they look terribly young, pitifully young to me. I hope to God they've had time to learn their profession. Are you away, Stephen?"
"I am. I mean to turn in, digest my buzzard in my cot, and sleep upon both ears for what is left of our time. Good night to you now." Stephen was perfectly calm, in rather higher spirits than usual, and Jack had no doubt that he would sleep until the morning. He envied him. Although long training usually allowed him to drop off at any moment, Jack knew that tonight he would have little rest. He was extremely anxious, both reasonably and unreasonably anxious. He called for a pot of coffee, and as he drank it, he checked his course again. The answer came out the same as before, but there were so many, many things that could go wrong, so many variables. One of the variables would have been absent if he had had time to pick his own officers, men like Pullings and Babington and Mowat, who had sailed with him for years, and whom he knew through and through, or any of the better midshipmen he had formed and who were now lieutenants. But of course these young fellows in the aerial's gunroom must know their profession. Young though they might be, they had all served afloat since their childhood, and the ship was in excellent order. Sir James had remarked upon it. "He had rarely seen a sloop of war in such good order." Hyde might be no 9 days wonder, no great seaman, but he was an adequate first lieutenant, a good disciplinarian, firm but no bully, while the master was an excellent navigator without any kind of doubt, and Fenton seemed above the average run of amiable, competent lieutenants, a man who might do very well if ever he had the good luck to be promoted. He dismissed that part of his anxiety as nonsense, and 10 minutes later he was on deck to see whether they knew what they were about. The rain had stopped. The sky was clearing. No moon, pitch dark. The ship was steering true, and a glance at the log-board showed that she had kept to a steady 6 knots. She was under topsails, with a single reef and an easy sheet. Fenton certainly knew how to sail her, although it was close on 3 bells in the graveyard watch, and although there was no duty in hand, the deck was unusually alive. The odd sheltered places forward or under the lee of the boats sheltered no sleeping figures, their heads wrapped in their jackets. All hands who were not high aloft were at the rails, staring out into the night. One of these was Wittgenstein, a Heligolander brought up in the Leith coal trade. As a midshipman, Jack had pressed him out of his collier, and they had sailed together in 3 or 4 commissions to their mutual liking. In the second of these, when Jack's navigation was still not all that it should have been, Wittgenstein was one of the prize crew with which Jack had to take a valuable merchantman into port of Spain, and thanks to Wittgenstein alone they had not only survived 2 very nasty blows that carried them a great way out of their course,
but found their way, 3 weeks overdue, to Trinidad. He came aft to trim a stern lantern, and Jack said,
"Well, Wittgenstein, I'm glad to see you again. It must be 7 or 8 years since we were shipmates. How do you come along?"
"Pretty spry, sir, thank God, though we are none of us as young as we was, and I see you are pretty spry too, sir,"
said Wittgenstein, looking at him keenly in the yellow glow.
"Well, fairly spry, all things considered."
Jack stayed on deck for a couple of glasses, and after that he appeared again from time to time to watch the steady working of the ship and gaze at the star-sprinkled sky. Mars was setting, tangled in Virgo, somewhere over Lithuania. Jupiter shone glorious astern. The night seemed never-ending, a continual easy glide through darkness. Yet he was asleep, sitting in the ingenious swinging chair that Draper had slung in the great cabin, when a midshipman came to tell him that a sail had been sighted. He had slept through the changing of the watch, and now as he came on deck the first streaks of dawn were showing. The binnacle lights still gleamed, and at first he could make out nothing but the line of the horizon.
"Just forward of the shifting backstay, sir," said the master who had the morning watch.
He caught the lifting fleck of white, trained his night-glass on it, and stared long and hard. No, it would not do. This was not his cat. It was too early for his cat. And in any case, the sail to leeward was steering south. Yet, on the other hand, a train of possibilities raced through his mind as he automatically slung his glass and climbed into the maintop, a serious and rather stern expression on his face. He knew from the Admiral that there were no British cruisers on this station apart from the brig Rattler, and this was a three-masted vessel. Then again, it was unlikely that any English merchantman should be sailing alone. They nearly all waited for convoy to protect them from the Danish privateers. The master followed him. The light was growing fast. The distant ship, for a ship she was, though small, hung there, an inverted image in his night-glass, somewhat dreamlike.
"She is no cat, neither," he observed, passing the telescope. "What do you make of her, Mr. Grimmond?"
"No cat, sir, I agree," said Grimmond, after a long searching pause. "I can see her t'gallant yards as plain as plain. I should not like to take my oath on it, but she looks rather like the Minnie, a Dane out of Aarhus. We saw her often last year, and chased her twice. She has a fine turn of speed on a bowline, and she lies very close indeed."
"Let us go up to the masthead, Mr. Grimmond," said Jack, calling to the lookout to slide down the stay.
There was barely room at the main cross-trees of so small a ship as the Ariel for a 16-stone post captain and a stoutly built master, and the frail spars creaked ominously. Grimmond was horribly embarrassed as well as frightened. Ordinarily, two such figures would have clung close together, but he could not bring himself to such familiarity with the person of Captain Aubrey, and he was obliged to adopt an odd, crucified posture between a shroud and a backstay. The first thing that Jack did was to search for his quarry, the cat heading for Riga. At this height he commanded a disk of sea 25 miles in diameter. There was no cat in it. Nor should there have been any cat. By all his calculations, she should still be over the southeastern horizon, crawling towards a point in the sea where the Ariel should cut her course at about the beginning of the forenoon watch.
"Yes, sir," said the master. "I'm almost sure she is the Minnie now. Her topsides are all black, and she carries a boat on stern davits."
"And what may she be?"
"Why, sir, sometimes she's a trader, sailing under our license, or dealing with the French on her own account. And sometimes she is most likely a privateer. Maybe both together when the opportunity offers. She certainly had no license when she ran from us, beating into Danzig."
"She is fast, you say?"
"Very fast on a wind, sir. But going large, the Ariel has the legs of her. We should have caught her the second time, but that she ducked in under the guns of Bornholm. We were coming up hand over fist."
"What does she carry?"
14 Danish six-pounders, sir."
A considerable armament for a merchantman, but even so no match for the Ariel. Jack considered, hanging there between the clear sky and the deck. The cat was hypothetical. Likely, but still hypothetical. She was desperately slow, and sailing or towing her down the Baltic would eat up a great deal of time. The Minnie was no sort of a hypothesis. She was there, plainly to be seen. She was fast. She was heading in the right direction. A chase would take him on his way, and she was under his lee.
"Very well, Mr. Grimmond," he said. "We will see if we can catch her this time."
And reaching out for a backstay, he slid down on deck in one long, smooth sweep. Apart from the very beginning, when he was fairly sure he could rely on the Minnie's lookout to ignore the aerial for a while, in the usual merchantman fashion, and then upon a demi-privateer's curiosity and eagerness for prey, he knew that there would be little room for guile in this pursuit. It would be a straightforward race, a match of speed, perhaps of seamanship, and there was all day to run it in, a fair wind and an open sea. He bitterly regretted his t'gallant masts, struck down on deck during yesterday's hard blow and never swayed up since. He had meant to leave it until both watches should be on deck. There would be no room for guile in the long run, but still it would be foolish not to take whatever advantage there was to be gained. They were nearly 5 miles apart, scarcely hull up from the deck, and it would take a long while to make up that distance, particularly as the Minnie already had her t'gallant yards crossed, and the aerial was rather deep laden. He sent her slanting casually across the sea to cross the Minnie's wake, still under topsails, suspended the ritual of washing the deck, stated that hammocks would not be piped up until further notice, ordered hammock cloths to be draped over the gun ports and t'gallant masts and yards laid along, ready to be swayed up and crossed at a moment's notice, with royals to follow them, and desired the officers to follow his example in changing their fine blue coats for pea jackets. He had gone to sea with only one uniform, his best, and the aerial's gunroom, supposing this to be his own choice, his normal standard of dress, had hitherto presented an appearance that would have done credit to a flagship, with blazing buttons, epaulettes, and eminent hats, visible a great way off, certain marks of a king's ship. He also sent most of the hands below, keeping only about a dozen in view. The Minnie sighted them earlier than Jack had expected. From the main top he saw her people running about, a surprisingly heavy crew, and an almost conclusive proof of her being a privateer, quite enough men to serve her 7 guns of a side, or to board and carry any ordinary Baltic merchantman. She rounded to for a closer look, and Jack called,
"Danish colours, Mr. Grimmond!"
The Minnie seemed pleased, and answered with the same, coming a little nearer.
"Steer to close her, Mr. Grimmond,"
said Jack in the waiting silence. But even as he spoke, the Minnie smelt a rat, turned on her heel, dropped her t'gansels, and fled southeast. Before the aerial had loosed hers, the chase already had her royals abroad, and the distance was growing rapidly. The delay irked Jack extremely. He could blame nobody but himself, and he urged the royal masts and yards aloft with a grim urgency that filled all hands with concern. Yet in time, masts, yards, and a spider's web of stays were where they should be. All sail the ship could bear was set and drawing drum tight. All falls were coiled down and cleared away, and the aerial, under her own colours and with her pennants streaming forward high over all, bore away in the Minnie's wake, gradually reaching the utmost speed that the fair breeze on her starboard quarter would allow. It was too soon to tell which was the happier on this point of sailing, but Jack was reasonably certain that he should overhaul the chase before the end of the day. There were few faster sloops in the service than Ariel, and he knew her pretty well by now.
"Very well, Mr. Hyde," he said. "I believe we may remove the hammock cloths and carry on with cleaning the decks."
The interrupted ship's day resumed its natural course. Sand and holystone scoured the worn white wood. Hammocks were piped up and stowed. The galley chimney started to smoke. Hands were piped to breakfast. And all this time the two ships raced over the morning sea. When Stephen came on deck, eager for his coffee, surprised and somewhat aggrieved at not even having smelt it yet, he was led, by a gentle midshipman, to the bows, where the captain and the master were training their sextants on the chase.
"Good morning to you, Doctor,"
said Jack.
"I hope you have slept well."
"Admirably well, I thank you, and am as a giant refreshed. My eyes are keen, my appetite and all my senses remarkably acute. Indeed, I perceive a sail a great way off, there, directly beyond the prow. But perhaps you have noticed it."
"Mr. Grimmond was good enough to point it out in the morning watch. She is your merchantman, though rather a queer one, and I'm happy to tell you we are gaining on her at last. She went away very quick to begin with."
"So that is why you are sailing so fast, with such a quantity of sails?"
"Many a stitch saves time," said Jack, "but I doubt we hold on to our royals much longer."
"The speed is quite exhilarating," said Stephen. "Do not you find the speed lift your heart, Mr. Grimmond? See how the grey billow rises. We part it. White foam flies down our side. The brave boat, she would cut a slender oat straw with the excellence of her going. I could watch it for ever, although breakfast is going cold in the cabin. I say, although my coffee grows chill, Captain Aubrey."
"I'm with you this minute," cried Jack.
And so he was, for the space of a dish of burgoo and half a dozen fried eggs with a due proportion of bacon, toast, and marmalade, Gothenburg and Karlskrona having done them so proud. But he carried his last cup of coffee on deck. He had chased for a fortune before now, but he had not chased with so great an urgency in his heart. From a merely personal point of view, he had undertaken to do a very difficult thing, and he must bring it off. But very much more than that, he fully understood the importance of the task in hand, the capital importance of Grimsholm. Nothing would prevent Stephen from making the attempt, nor should it. Jack had the greatest confidence in his powers, yet Stephen's danger must be far less if he were set down on the island before the French officers arrived, perhaps to reverse the whole situation. The Frenchmen had reached Hollenstein on Tuesday, and if they took passage in such a flyer as the Minnie, they might be in Grimsholm very, very soon indeed. It was, in fact, by no means impossible that they would aboard her this minute. Her course would agree perfectly with such a voyage. His officers, or most of them, were competent, but they had nothing like his experience in driving a ship, in getting the last ounce of thrust out of the breeze, and as the morning wore on, this proved a tricky breeze into the bargain, sometimes coming in gusts strong enough to endanger her topgallants, if not the upper masts themselves. A tricky opponent, too. The Minnie, put to her shifts, tried every change of helm to probe the Ariel's best point of sailing, every combination of sails. Jack responded to all of these, and to every variation in the wind. Stunsails flashed out aboard the sloop, stunsails aloft and alow on either side as occasion served, bonnets, drabblers, and just before they parted, so they were taken in. There was an atmosphere of pleasurable tension and excitement in the Ariel. The hands jumped to their work. They plied the hoses in the tops, wetting the sails for a slightly greater thrust with a jet that reached the yard, and they whipped buckets up to the cross-trees to soak the topgallants with a splendid zeal, and as often as not they were ready at the sheets or halyards with an intelligent anticipation before the order was given. The gain was slight, sometimes no more than a cable's length in an hour, but it was certain. The chase had been hull up since the middle of the forenoon watch. By the time of the noonday observation, the Minnie had proved to her own satisfaction that she lost least by putting directly before the wind, and so she sailed, under a noble pyramid of canvas, starting her water over the side and tossing her guns after it, 14 splashes that lightened her by as many tons. "Shall you come to dinner?" asked Stephen 2 hours later. "The steward is in a great taking, and declares the sucking pig will be spoilt."
"No," said Jack. "Do you see his sables? The damn thing about chasing in the Baltic is that they nearly always have better gear, best Riga sailcloth, and such hemp for their cordage, and they can crack on when we dare not. That day needs watching. I shall take a bite on deck. A damn good seaman."
"Will he succeed in running clear, do you suppose?"
"I hope not, I'm sure. At the present rate of sailing, and if nothing carries away, we should be up with her a little after sunset. But this is a cross-grained breeze, and the more it slackens, the less we gain. The Minnie is going very well, and I believe she would be happiest in very light airs. She swims high, you see, and I'm pretty sure she's been new-coppered. All the officers agree that she has never shown such a turn of speed. She would be the very thing for the Admiral. He is in great need of avisos."
"You are confident of taking her, I find."
"Oh, I should never say anything as unlucky as that. I should never count the bear's skin before it is hatched. Oh, no. I only mean that were she taken, she might be brought into the service. There is a fair chance, a very fair chance. But above all, I hope to come up with her before night sets in. This is the dark of the moon, and there will be precious little starshine."
The long, long afternoon, and still they ran. In spite of their increased numbers, the Ariel's crew were growing jaded with the incessant shifting of the upper sails and the pumping.
But it was just as bad, or even worse, aboard the Chase, reflected Jack, and in any case he had now settled upon the best trim. Naked mizzen, both main sheets aft, for topmast scandalized, forecourse in the brails, all the fore stunsails setting beautifully and the bowsprit fully clothed. And now the hands should have a rest. What he really feared was the rising glass and the falling of the wind, which would certainly favour the lighter Minnie. Not that in his deepest, least avowed conviction he had any doubt of overhauling her sooner or later, even after a gust had blown the main royal out of its bolt-rope. But sooner was so infinitely important, he reflected, looking angrily at the Minnie's unyielding canvas as his own flimsy, worn-out Admiralty No. 8 raced aloft to replace the streaming sail. The true cold fear, the doubt of total failure, did not come to him until much later, when the setting sun began to swallow the breeze, and the Minnie drew perceptibly ahead. She had been within very long gunshot this last hour, and he had cleared away the bow chasers long since, but at no time had he been willing to maul a ship that he would have to use, and now there was a likelihood that gunfire would stun the remaining wind. Yet it might be the right solution, for if the Minnie gained like this, and if the breeze kept light and true, she might waft into Grimsholm before him, and the island was directly in her path, and by now it was no great way off. A night's sail, perhaps. Having ordered the perilous expedient of a skysail on the main, perilous because the Ariel's royal mast had been sprung when the sail blew out, he turned the question over in his mind. The little quarter-deck was crowded, all the officers and young gentlemen having been there with scarcely a break since the beginning of the chase, but if they spoke at all, it was in low voices. Now they were all silent, waiting for what would happen when the skysail was sheeted home. The only sound that reached Jack in his holy area of deck by the starboard rail was the conversation between Dr. Maturin and Jagiello. The significance of the skysail escaped them entirely, and they talked away with the freedom of perfect ignorance.
"Pray, Mr. Jagiello," said Stephen, "what is the coast we see? Would it be part of Courland, or perhaps of Pomerania, or am I much astray?"
"I am totally in the sea," said Jagiello, cheerfully. "It might be anywhere. All this part of the Baltic coast is much the same. Flat, with immense sand dunes for miles and miles, and shallow water. It is sterile, barren, no good to anybody, but Poles and Swedes and Russians and Germans have fought for it for hundreds of years. I can see a ruined castle with the telescope, but I cannot tell what it is." He passed the glass, adding, "The only thing it does produce is amber."
"Amber!" cried Stephen.
And at the same time a collective sigh rose from the professional part of the quarter-deck. The skysail held, and a scrap of canvas, for it was no more, gave the Ariel a slightly greater thrust, just enough to prevent the chase from gaining. This did not resolve Jack's problem, however, and he found himself wishing, with uncommon vehemence and a vexation of spirit rare in him, that the talk about amber, its origin, its electrical properties, its uses in classical antiquity, Thales of Miletus on amber, might stop.
"Mr. Hyde, let the water be—"
he began, his eyes fixed on the Minnie. But to his astonishment he saw her shift her helm, altering course to larboard until she had the breeze 3 points abaft the beam. He cut his sentence short and gave out a volley of orders. "Driver, mizzen topsail, t'gallant, and royal forecourse for topsail, together with the crowd of stunsails and staysails that had been useless with the wind dead aft. And now the Ariel's strong crew of man-of-war's men showed to full advantage. This cloud of canvas broke out with astonishing rapidity. Sheets were tallied aft and belayed before the Minnie had spread more than half of hers. But even before this was done, even before Stephen and Jagiello had been tumbled about more than twice by racing groups of men, Jack had sent a midshipman to the masthead. The Minnie's change of course seemed mere suicide. Not only had she proved that the Ariel outpaced her sailing large like this, proved it much earlier in the day, but now she had lost a cable's length in the last few minutes. On such a course she must lose close on a mile in an hour, even with all the sail she possessed abroad, and the sun was still a hand's breadth from the horizon. The only explanation he could think of was that she had seen an ally inshore or an enemy in the offing.
"On deck there!"
hailed the midshipman.
"A sail, sir! A sail! 2 points on the starboard bow!"
"Do you make out a pennant?"
he called. It was an idle question. If the Minnie had not seen the pennant, the mark of a man of war, she would never have sheered off, but he wanted confirmation of his joy.
"Oh, yes, sir! And I believe I know her! Hermaphrodite on the starboard tack! She's coming about!"